I'd like to begin by recognizing that we are gathered here today in Ottawa, part of the traditional unceded territory of the Algonquin Anishinaabe people. And as always, Canada 2020 is grateful to be part of this land's continued history of sharing and exchange, and to hopefully build on that with the conversation today. I'm Braden Cayley, President and CEO of Canada 2020, and today I also want to extend a very special thank you to the DAIS at Toronto Metropolitan University, our partners on today's event, offering essential leadership on these issues as well, including democracy protection and sharing in so much of Canada 2020's mission of building a fairer, more prosperous, and more progressive future for Canada and the world. Now, 2024 will go down as one of the world's biggest election years ever, with approximately 2 billion people heading to the polls. That means nearly half the people on Earth live in countries that will hold national elections this year. And no election will have impacts echo more widely, of course, than the United States of America, our closest ally and economic partner anywhere in the world. Here in Canada, American politics and government have a very real effect on our lives, not just culturally, but in shared security, economic, and climate landscapes, to name just a few. And while Super Tuesday this week didn't have too many surprises, I know that many in this room will be tuned in tonight for the State of the Union address, where President Biden will continue to make the case for the success of his presidency, and we can presume the protection of democracy in the United States and beyond, and the value of a bold progressive agenda. Today, we're very fortunate to have a special guest uniquely positioned to speak on just this and on many of the corollary questions, and I'm sure you're all anxious to hear from her. So without further ado, please join me in giving a very warm welcome to the former Special Assistant to the President, Senior Speechwriter for President Barack Obama, and Senior Fellow with the DAIS at Toronto Metropolitan University, Sarada Perry. Please give her a warm welcome. Thank you so much for being here. We're really happy, actually, to have you back.
Yes.
Sarada had been with Canada 2020 in 2019 for an event that looked ahead to a lot of the 2020 cycle, and so it's great to be able to have you here. Once again, translating so much of what is on many of our minds as we face yet another election cycle. But let's talk about that cycle and also what's led into it, and start with a little bit of your assessment, how the campaign maybe is shaping up so far in a week that has had Super Tuesday, even if it didn't count for as much as it may have in the past, but also where the Biden administration has gone so far itself, 3.5 years into it, and what that's meant for you as an American with the experience that you have in the White House and otherwise.
Well, thank you for having me. Thank you all for coming. It is a very stressful week in Washington, so I'm absolutely thrilled to not be there and be here with all of you fine people. Super Tuesday was not a surprise. And we ended up with the race, the rematch, that it seems like nobody really wants, but here we are. That said, I think the Biden administration has an incredible record to run on. He has presided over the most job growth. We have record low unemployment, record high GDP. He has passed historic bipartisan legislation, including the biggest investments in climate that we've ever made. He has restored America's leadership in the world after a period of time where countries really didn't know whether they could count on America. And at the same time, he's defended some real progressive priorities, including reproductive rights and abortion. And so, you know, there's just a whole range of issues the Biden administration can run on a really strong record. And now, I think there was sort of a feeling that in the fall, especially, where was the campaign? And that was in part just by design, because Trump wasn't officially the nominee. Now that we have a nominee, you're seeing the campaign kind of really gin up. They're being far more aggressive than they have been up until now. And I think you're going to see them make a really strong case, including tonight, for his reelection. That said, we are in an incredibly polarized country, as you all know. And the truth is that party tribalism is real. And the unfavorability that you're seeing of President Biden, some of that is just baked into the cake of polarization. So, look, I'm worried. and I'm also optimistic that they've got a really strong record to run on. So we'll see what happens.
Well, and you mentioned tonight in the State of the Union address, and obviously speech writing is such a hallmark of your own career and communications more broadly, of which tonight is one of the ultimate megaphones of that in American democracy. So can you share for us a little bit of what it's like to shape the rhetoric and the message strategy for an opportunity like that, where you're speaking not just to all of the United States Congress at a key moment with an election just 6 or 7 months away, but of course to the American people and to the world with the choices of this year now in a much clearer level of perspective.
Well, from the perspective of a speech, the State of the Union is a nightmare because, you know, when you deliver a speech, when you write a speech, you want it to be a message, a sort of clear message that is persuasive and compelling, that tells a story. And unfortunately, because the State of the Union is by definition the president's message to Congress on how things are going, it is inevitably a laundry list of priorities. And so, you know, every year the president, when I was in the White House, the president would say, this year we're going to make it a story and it's going to be 20 minutes. And of course, you know, that's impossible and it's going to be over an hour long. It's always consequential. And I think we're going to talk about the media, but in part because the media is basically forced to cover this speech. And so for one of the few times, Americans are going to tune in more than they typically do. So President Biden has this opportunity to deliver his message, but it's also, so it has to be both a state of what's going on, but also him laying out the marker for what he's going to propose for 2024. And really, this is the kickoff, I would say, from my perspective of the campaign. So the stakes are really high. That said, I think maybe more than for most states of the union and for most presidents, what's going to be really important here is, yes, the words, but maybe even more the performance of it. People are going to be looking to see how Biden performs this speech. And I think what they want to see is him coming out swinging like he did last year.
And we can talk about message strategy without talking about the media, as you did a little bit, and how they're forced to cover it. But there are some that are not. And there are, of course, new ways that, you know, aren't so much about coverage as about channels through which a message is received. Of course, now as we move through the 2024 campaign, and a campaign that, like each of the ones progressively over the last four, is going to be one of the most online, or certainly the most online campaign that we will have seen so far. So I would ask about a different kind of media, and Canadians have been no stranger to a large-scale array of further-right media ecosystem, whether it's been what we've seen from Rebel or voices like Jordan Peterson from Canada, but certainly in the U.S., and they've often been hand in glove, others like Tucker Carlson or Joe Rogan or even Elon Musk. Elon Musk met with President Trump earlier this week in West Palm Beach, I understand. So I'm curious on your take about the American progressive media ecosystem right now. Is there one?
You know, what's tricky about this, well, let's just back up for a second. So the right-wing media ecosystem, we all, you know, you all know about it, and it has been building for years. It is incredibly powerful and well-funded, but it has really become an arm of the Republican Party, and of course, even more so deeply in the Trump years. So if the Republican Party sees the right-wing media as its arm, then of course it is going to be well-funded and supported and able to saturate this space. But on the Democratic side sees the mainstream media as its where it puts out its message. And of course, the mainstream media is not biased. You know, people say that there may be disproportionately larger numbers of liberal reporters, but that's not really what comes out in the news. So if one party is relying on its own, you know, propaganda, and the other party is relying on the good faith of reporters to just report its message, that's not going to happen. And so there has been a slight growth of progressive media. You know, attempts have been made, but nothing has ever really stuck. I would say Crooked Media, which is a media company that was started by some of former President Obama's speechwriters and press staff, has done a pretty good job, I would say, of building up some kind of ecosystem. And I think you're going to continue to see that. But the truth is, we're far from having the kind of ecosystem that the right wing has. That said, I do think that Democratic electeds, including this White House, are doing a better job of moving past the mainstream media, not depending on, you know, earned media to get out its message. And you're seeing that actually just, I think it was either yesterday or today, the Biden White House is meeting with a bunch of influencers and internet personalities and sort of the media ecosystem of the social media to get out its message, to talk about the State of the Union. And that, to me, is the way to do it, because you can't rely on the traditional media to get out our messages. That's not their job.
Well, and maybe let's just expand on that a little bit, too, because it was another Canadian, as many in the audience will be familiar, Marshall McLuhan, who had said the medium is the message. And, you know, as you've addressed, the Biden administration, I think, has gone to some very good lengths to get to different personalities of influence online and work with them where there are shared interests or issue priorities to get that out, and some, you know, lighthearted ones too. Today, for instance, I encourage everyone to take a look. He was with a whole bunch of people who had played presidents on TV, asking them for advice on delivering a State of the Union. But, you know, where do you think they can bring meaning to that phrase we've now heard a lot of politics of, we need to go where people are? Someone who's a veteran campaigner recently said to me, we need to go where people are, but if you show up wearing a suit and everyone else is wearing a bikini, it's not going to be very effective. How do you go where people are in a way that is really meaningful, you think, to get a message out from an occasion like tonight or otherwise?
I think there's multiple challenges here, but already it's about playing to your strengths, right? So President Biden is somebody who, when he's with people, normal people, does very well. And, you know, he is a retail politician, and he doesn't need to try to be somebody he's not. He just needs to be himself with different audiences through the mediums and the channels that they are at. So, for example, if he wants to reach young people, he doesn't need to pretend to be young and cool. He just needs to be himself, but reaching them in the channels that they access and using language that is authentic to him, which is pretty, you know, plain spoken. So I think there's that element of it. I think the challenge generally, though, in this environment is that you've got the need to reach people through these channels outside of the mainstream media. But the mainstream media is still setting the broader narrative, and you can't escape that. So yes, maybe the average person isn't reading the New York Times, but the way that those major outlets kind of shape how people think about politics is real. And so you have to find a way to do both, which is a huge challenge.
Well, and I think with that, we can maybe shift some gears into some of the policy impacts on the election. There's been a lot of reporting about a potentially sizable number of progressive or younger-leaning Americans who have been dissatisfied with the Biden administration on a few different areas, most pronounced recently around his positions on a ceasefire or not and the kind of calls made for such with respect to Gaza. We had seen that there was a 13% vote for uncommitted in Michigan. There were many similar results in the Super Tuesday results that we saw this week. Now, you could argue, so did, you know, the Obama 2012 primary campaign see some similar results at different times. But how much do you think that that dynamic is a threat to Biden as he looks toward the general election or not?
In my mind, the discontent that was registered, you know, in Michigan, in Minnesota, in different places is a really important signal, right? It is, you know, you're hearing from some of these organizers who say, we supported President Biden, and this is our way of signaling this is a problem that you need to address. So in a way, I know that people were frustrated by that, by the numbers, and frustrated by people saying that they were voting uncommitted and actually voting uncommitted. But from my perspective, it was actually a really important signal. It's what your friends do when they give you a warning. So I will, and I also think that the strategy of those organizers has in fact pushed the administration. You know, the administration will say that they've been pushing Israel to take a different tack for quite some time, but they've been doing it quietly. Now you're seeing it come out more in the open. So this week, Vice President Harris was very explicit about calling for an immediate ceasefire. You have not seen that yet. And, you know, the reporting is that she has been sort of calling for this internally for a long time. And now finally, she said the quiet part out loud. And I have to credit the people who were organizing and speaking out for that. I do think that in general, there is some progressive discontent that goes beyond Gaza. And the fact that young people don't seem excited and motivated is, in fact, a problem. You know, the enthusiasm gap is real. So you could argue that Trump has just a numerical ceiling in the number of people who will support him. However, if we have an enthusiasm gap, if we can't turn out the same coalition that won Biden, that voted for Biden in 2020, we're going to have a problem. So it's going to be incumbent upon this campaign to really reach out to those young people and say that they're being heard. And the truth is, again, they've got a record to run on, right? So they've just, working on reducing student debt. They've forgiven student debt for huge numbers of students. They're working on basically making the cost of living something that's easier for working families, all these things that young people care about. So they just have to get out. I mean, I'm not one of those people who says, if we just tell people what we did, they're going to vote for us. I don't actually think that's true. But I do think that the polling shows that people don't know anything about President Biden's accomplishments. And young people don't know that what he's doing is fighting for them. That's really what people want to hear. And they want to see him have some fight. So that's going to be the challenge going forward. And my hope is that if they can communicate back to these communities that we are hearing what you're saying, we are trying to address what your concerns are. And in the case of something like Gaza, it is just super complicated, but we're trying, that that could potentially get some folks back. You're not going to get everybody back, but you could get some people back.
Well, and I think probably it's especially true for younger generations, but a rule that I've often had with political speeches too would be dividing a bit of a formula where, you know, if it's six pieces, one, about your record and where you've come, two, about what people are facing and feeling today, and three, the future and what's at stake and what's possible for them too. And it sounds like that's a lot of what you think young people need to hear more of going forward.
I do. And I also think, I mean, and again, I think you're going to start to hear this tonight and clearly going forward, the contrast is really, really important, because the alternative is a Donald Trump who doesn't care about anybody but himself, right? And so what he is calling for is a turn backwards 60 years, as Biden says, and the things that he wants to do. Do we think that he's going to implement policies that will actually help young people? No. What his plans are, you know, he's the one who appointed Supreme Court justices to overturn Roe v. Wade. He's the one who passed a giant tax cut for his rich friends and corporations. All these things that are actually incredibly unpopular, while you have President Biden who's, you know, reducing the cost of insulin and trying to forgive people's student debt. Just a really clear contrast. So they just need to go, they need to go hard on that, which they are absolutely going to do. And we need to reach young people where they are.
On that alternative is perhaps where we can take a little bit of a darker turn for a moment and indulge our anxieties perhaps a little bit.
Group therapy.
Yes. You know, we've already touched the surface on a few of the possibilities of, you know, the prospects for threats that a second Trump presidency may present to Americans or the world, whether it's things like on national security, international partnerships, women's rights, queer rights, trans rights specifically, democracy, protection itself, independence of the judiciary, climate, we could go on. But what worries you, you know, the most? What, you know, do you think your fellow Americans are most anxious about on the progressive side of things when they think about what this really could be in terms of a second Trump presidency if that was the result of this campaign in November?
All of the things that you mentioned are deeply concerning, and also equally concerning, as I'm sure you all, you know, feel as our friendly northern neighbors, is that the trend of authoritarianism around the world is deeply troubling, right? So you're seeing all over the world strongmen like Narendra Modi in India or Viktor Orban in Hungary, just all of these people who are gaining power is deeply problematic. So you know, and then, of course, all the individual issues can keep us all up at night and do keep me up at night. I would say more broadly, though, I keep going back to January 6th, and I keep going back to the fact that after, you know, 200 years, we did not actually have a peaceful transfer of power. It is not a peaceful transfer of power if people die in the Capitol, right? If police officers were attacked by a marauding mob of people egged on by a president who refuses to acknowledge the legitimate winner of an election and whose supporters still do not acknowledge that the 2020 election results were legitimate. They still don't. And so when I think about what could happen in November and beyond, it is, first of all, if Joe Biden wins, do we think that Donald Trump is going to go quietly into the night? What havoc will he wreak? The fact that there are sitting Republican members of Congress who have said they acquitted him in part because they faced threats of violence, and their families did too. So we're in a real sort of crisis from that perspective. But then if he does win, what happens then? You know, I am your retribution. This is what he says. This is the kind of what he has promised going forward is something really terrifying. And so, and I don't see how you get out of it from that at that point. Once he's in, how do we get out? So I don't mean to be dark, but I think we're in a really dangerous spot. And it's interesting because I think some of what you're seeing in terms of discontent on the left within the Democratic Party, frustration that we have a rematch, it's because the energy within the Democratic Party, I think, is ready to really move forward, move beyond this generation, start pushing for real progressivism, address challenges like climate. But we are locked in this cycle of just trying to survive, just wresting our democracy from this crazy man and his supporters. And at some point, it just feels like, come on, you know, we want something different. And but we can't have it right now. We cannot have nice things right now. And not that Joe Biden is not a nice thing. I think he's been an excellent president. You know, I don't agree with him on everything. Frankly, I'm really unhappy with what's happening in Gaza. But I still think he has been an excellent president and he's somebody I support. That said, I understand why there is a frustration with this feeling like, why are we doing this again? And the truth is we have to keep doing this until we deal with this threat. Well, sorry, the last thing I'll say about this, clearly you can tell I feel strongly, is that, you know, we talk a lot about Trump and Trumpism, whatever that might mean. But I, in a way, feel like we are all beholden to and paralyzed by Trump's supporters. It is his supporters who have put us in the situation where individual people have all this outsized power, where, you know, the Supreme Court might rule in a certain way because they are worried about political violence. Where, I mean, yes, Trump exit on, but he has created a group of people, or maybe that group of people was always going to evolve in this direction. I feel strongly that the Republican Party laid a very clear path to where we are. But those people are a problem, and we have to figure out how to undo that. We have to figure out how to actually grapple with it and not just say Trump, Trump, Trump. Yes, he is, of course, the manifestation of the problem and the, you know, leader of the problem, but there are a whole huge number of people in our country who are going along with it, and we have to solve that.
Well, and that rings true. I think that it's a dynamic of polarization towards further right in many communities that we've seen globalized far beyond a Trump only, America only context as well. Yes, there's many edges of that here as well. In fact, there was one Abacus poll that I think only a month ago found that support for Trump amongst young men in Canada was comparable or perhaps higher than it was in the United States. I mean, it was jarring to many people. I will, you know, you've touched on the domestic security threat that can come from the democracy threat that may be posed by that kind of result in the United States. I'm going to broaden that to the international security aspects to it. Just a few weeks ago, former President Trump had encouraged Russia to, quote, do whatever the hell they want, quote, to NATO members that he thought are not paying their fair share. You know, and, you know, there are questions about defense spending in many NATO countries, and not to excuse his comment in the absolute slightest. But, you know, in fact, according to an Angus Reid poll released earlier this week, 53% of respondents in Canada had said Canada should increase its military spending level to 2% of GDP in alignment with the NATO benchmark. That support jumped to 65% when the idea of a second Donald Trump presidency was introduced to the question and factored in. What would you say are the risks internationally, you know, whether that's in Europe or more specifically to a country like Canada, who shares not just the world's largest undefended border, but so many, as I said in the opening, cultural and economic ties and landscapes with the United States and its people?
I think the challenge with someone like Trump and the danger for everybody is I guess, maybe just the more extreme version of what we saw last time, where you guys can't count on us anymore, right? We're supposed to be able to count on each other. And for decades, we have had this relationship. And the notion that we would not be able to support Canada the way Canada supports us, the way we always have, is, I think, really terrifying. And I take your point about NATO. I mean, I think the fact, what's so interesting about Trump is that he sort of touches on this truth and just goes too far with it. So sure, we can say that other NATO member states should be spending more of their GDP on defense. And that is something that's really popular when he says it to Americans. And yet, it is an incredibly important investment for America to make in NATO and specifically in Ukraine, right, to prevent any sort of further incursion and to protect us, all of us. And the absence of that and the fact that he is, you know, he comes off as this sort of strongman, but he's actually very weak. And when he is in power, sort of going along with these people like Putin and Xi Jinping demonstrates his weakness, just makes the rest of us seem really weak too. And so I think our allies like Canada understand this clearly. And I think it's why everybody is watching this election with bated breath and terror. But I think that threat is real. And I don't, you know, I worry about the sort of, it's not just comedy. It is these alliances that we depend on that are not perfect, of course, and that, you know, there are evolutions that need to be had. And yet the idea that this one person and his ideology can sort of collapse that at a time when other ideologies are attractive, when someone like Narendra Modi is really doing well and incredibly popular, is troubling.
Well, and then maybe let's move off Trump at least a little bit then to speak about some of that broader global context. And there's a lot going on in the world beyond the U.S. election, as much as that is the bulk of our conversation today. As I mentioned on the way in, we've got elections in Mexico, India, over 15 African countries, 15 European countries, including the United Kingdom. You know, something our advisory board chair, Mark Carney, has said is that this is a time of great rewirings, right? We are seeing, you know, global trade networks and partnerships being rewired after what we've seen in the pandemic and in the aftermath of the war in Ukraine. You're seeing our energy systems rewired with the green transition and moving to net zero, and now intelligence itself being rewired. You know, and so for that to be taking place as we're having the world's biggest election year, what do you think is, you know, important about that for voters to be thinking about in the lens of a progressive agenda? It's a pivotal moment for many ways, not just the outcome of the U.S. election that we've been talking about so far.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not a national security expert, and you can find people who are far smarter on policy than I am. So I will just talk about this from a communications perspective. There has been a level of fear and anxiety around the rapid changes that have been happening in the world. And frankly, they haven't been all that rapid, right? I mean, I remember when I was in college in the 90s, everybody protesting the World Trade Organization. So this has been going on for a long time. I think where progressives need to step up is in offering an affirmative vision of what this world can look like, where everybody can find a place for themselves, as opposed to just sort of saying, these forces are after us and we must just push them off as though there is any chance of that happening. There isn't. So what are we offering? What are we saying that we want this world order to look like? What potential rules of the road do we want all of us to sign up to as allies? What do we expect of the tech companies that are making a whole lot of money off of our data, among other things? And you know, what can we say we believe it should look like? People are desperate for some kind of vision. And it can't just be defensive. It can't just be not that. And I don't think that's just true of our countries in the West. I think that's true everywhere. And so I would hope that all of our sort of progressive communities and, you know, we all work together, right? There are alliances between Canada 2020 and progressive organizations in the U.S. You know, I'm here as part of the DAIS, which is this, you know, working really hard to bring together people across our borders. I think all of us, it's incumbent upon all of us to offer that. And I feel like there's a lot of work to do on that.
You know, on that note about, and maybe you've partially answered this, but how can we make sure, especially younger generations, but everyone, feel like democracy is delivering for them in a positive way, not only a defensive way? You know, we've seen some troubling research in the United States and in many countries, democracies amongst the G20, that younger generations don't necessarily believe to the same degree that democracy is the best system of government, which, of course, is a red flag in allowing much of the track to be laid for the kinds of problems and threats to it that we've talked about today. So how do we communicate to people about democracy delivering and making life better for people?
Well, it has to actually deliver for them. It's not just enough to communicate it to them. I've been thinking a lot about President Franklin Roosevelt and the 1932 election. It's at the height of the Great Depression, and his Republican predecessor, Herbert Hoover, just was not able to and did not really believe that government had a role to play in helping people get out of the situation. And, you know, he did do some. He gets a bad rep. And he did push government in some directions to sort of provide basic relief to people. But, you know, when a quarter of the public is unemployed and hungry and, you know, there are entire communities that are just hollowed out, it's not enough to say, it'll be okay. Business will help you, right? And FDR saw this not just as kind of an economic challenge, but at a time when totalitarianism is rising in Europe, he is looking over there and saying, there is something appealing about this ideology that the state will take care of everything, regardless of the ramifications that come from that. There is something appealing about this. And my campaign and my desire to put in place the New Deal, which it would eventually happen after he won, is, yes, an economic issue, but it is also a political issue and an issue of democracy. I have to make sure that people understand that their government does have a role and that we will help. And so, you know, it is not a perfect analogy, but I keep thinking about that because when we need to find a way to, again, with this affirmative vision, build a situation where young people feel like their future is not at stake. I mean, I think about this for myself and for my kids. Are my kids actually going to have a better life than I do when everybody is telling me that AI is going to put us all out of work? That doesn't feel really good. And I feel like I'm a pretty aware person. I pay attention and I'm not feeling great about the situation. How is the, you know, somebody who doesn't pay such close attention to politics going to feel about it? Not great. And so, again, rather than just kind of having this doomsday view of things, we need to put forward something that makes people feel like the world we want to build, at least aspirationally, has a place for everybody. Otherwise, that I think that some of that negativity isn't just about ourselves and our current lot in life. You know, people are always wondering, the economy is doing really well in the U.S. Why don't people feel good? I think part of that is just this anxiety in the back of your mind that my kids aren't going to do as well. And so addressing that feels really important. And I don't have an answer as to what that should be. But I think it really is incumbent upon us to do it, not just for the sake of the economy, but for the sake of our democracies.
Well, and those kids themselves feeling like they may not be able to get ahead.
Absolutely.
Gen Z and has come of age in the scope of a global financial crisis and then a global health crisis. And, you know, I think often of housing as perhaps the ultimate economic issue right now in Canada, so much the United States, other peer countries where people simply don't feel they have the access too much of the time to what their parents' generation may have had or their grandparents' generation. And so clearly that's a big challenge for all persuasions, but progressives to be grappling with too.
From my perspective, I think that we just need to be going hard on this idea that there are a group of people who are completely out of touch with the lived experience of most families, that they don't actually care about our families. And I think that we need to go hard on taking back the word freedom. So for a long time, the right wing has co-opted this notion of freedom. I'm not exactly clear how it happened, but it's done. It's over. Because what they are doing is instead taking away our freedom to control our own bodies. They are taking away freedom to control our own families and decide how our families live. The freedom to raise our children how we wish. The freedom to read books that are available in our free public libraries. The freedom to vote. The freedom to make sure that my kids can go to school without being shot. There are a range of issues on which they have completely abdicated this most fundamental American value. Let's take that value back.
We'll begin to wrap up, but I want to make sure that we do that wrapping up in a solution-oriented way. It's hard to do sometimes when individual action is just a part of what we are discussing in these big challenges, but let's try. And if you had a call to action for progressives, policymakers, strategists, activists, engaged citizens in the United States, in Canada, of how to be better messengers for their values and their value in facing these challenges and opportunities together, what might that be?
Yeah, this will not be succinct, but I alluded to this earlier. I think it's all well and good for us to kind of engage in group therapy and have a little bedwetting about what's going to happen and our trepidations and our fears about Donald Trump and our anxieties about what's going to happen. It's all well and good, and that's not enough. we also need to put on our big kid pants and fight for the world we want. And if we still believe in democracy, which I think we should, we need to teach our kids why it's important and why it matters in their lives. And we need to, once again, create and develop an affirmative vision for the future we want and then just hammer it home and not just accept the premises that are offered to us by a right wing that is benefiting from people's cynicism. You know, President Obama always would say that people, when people feel like the system isn't working for them, then they are by definition going to become cynical and they're not going to participate in the system, which means the system won't work for them. And it just is a cycle. And we have to get out of that. So I think events like this are really important. Partnerships like this are really important. Let's get more Canadians and Americans together. But I do think that it is a kind of global call for progressives everywhere to be doing this work together and to offer something that is hopeful and affirmative that people can look up to and want to be a part of.